Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Harlan, Kentucky is coal country. It earned the moniker Bloody Harlan back in the 1930s and again in the 1970s when miners fought for better pay and working conditions. Lives back then were lost and bones were broken. Well, since late July of 2019 in Harlan, in the town of Cumberland, miners and their families have been blockading a train loaded with coal they mined but never got paid for.
No pay, no coal!
Amen!
No pay!
No broken bones and no violence this time, but the miners are determined to see this through until they get paid. This hour on Point, we'll hear voices from Kentucky on the miners' protest and the future they see for themselves and their families. And you can join us. What is your question for Kentucky's coal miners? Join us anytime on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And a little later this hour, we'll go to England to hear the latest on Boris Johnson and his very controversial parliamentary gambit to force Brexit through. But first, we're going to talk about Kentucky. And by the way, I want to give a big hello to WESA and our newest listeners in Pittsburgh. So hello, Pittsburgh, and welcome to On Point. So let's get to Kentucky now. Joining us now is Sydney Bowles in Whitesburg, Kentucky. She's a reporter with the journalism partnership Ohio Valley Resource, working out of public radio station WWMT. And Sydney's beat focuses on the economic transitions in coal country. We have links to her pieces at onpointradio.org. Sydney, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So first of all, for folks who haven't been caught up to this story of what's happening in Harlan County, can you just quickly give us the background? Why did the mine where the miners work get shuttered so quickly?
Sure. So Black Jewel was one of the six, or it was the sixth largest coal company in the country, essentially, and it filed for bankruptcy on July 1st, essentially without warning. So over 1,000 coal miners in West Virginia, Kentucky, and Virginia, as well as several hundred miners in Black Jewel mines in Wyoming, found themselves suddenly told to stop coming into work, but they weren't officially laid off. So miners got their last paycheck on June 28th, and then, of course, that was the end of the month, so they spent that paycheck on rent, mortgages, car payments, those beginning-of-the-month expenses, only to find out a few days later that those paychecks had bounced. And then the subsequent paycheck, their final paycheck from the middle of July, also didn't come through. So it's been two months now, essentially, with almost no information for these miners and just this sort of sense of a lack of clarity about what's going on for them, when they can expect to go back to work and what their status is.
And tell me a little bit more about what triggered this bankruptcy.
So Black Jewel, We are seeing a lot of bankruptcies in the coal industry these days as the industry contracts due to a number of market forces that we can go into a little more. Mm-hmm. But Black Jewel's business model was kind of a funny one. They essentially bought up mines through other bankruptcies, and then due to some like quirky mismanagement of their own, as well as market forces that were impacting them, they just found themselves in too much debt to make things work. So they filed for bankruptcy.
So quirky business practices, though? I mean, meaning what?
I wouldn't want to go too far into that. I think a lot of that is still being hashed out in the courts. But it does seem like the best decisions weren't necessarily made by the folks on top there, specifically CEO Jeff Hoops. So he's no longer with the company, but I think we are seeing a lot of bankruptcies in the coal industry. But I will say the Black Jewel bankruptcy was uniquely chaotic.
Okay, so you mentioned former CEO of Black Jewel, Jeff Hoops, which you managed to actually get him on the phone not that long ago. He's been laying really low since Black Jewel had to declare bankruptcy. So the day after the blockade began, you got him on the phone. First of all, tell us, how'd you do that? Because lots of people have tried and they weren't successful.
It was a total surprise to me. The protest started Monday, July 29th, and it was total chaos. You know, I was unprepared. I was just flying by the seat of my pants, as were the miners. You know, everyone was just figuring out what this was going to look like. So I went back to the tracks on Tuesday morning, and I was, you know, as surprised as anyone to see that the miners had spent the night there and that they were insisting that they would continue blockading this railroad track until they got the thousands of dollars that they were owed from Black Jewel. So I figured, well, I guess I should try and get in touch with them. But I'm standing at the railroad track. All I have is my cell phone. So I take myself to www.blackjewel.com, call up the number, and it gives me this menu to type in, you know, the name of the person I'm trying to reach. And what do you know? Jeff Hoops picks up the phone.
I'm sure he probably regretted doing that, but I'm glad that he did. So let's listen to your interaction with Jeff Hoops, the former CEO of the Black Jewel Mining Company, when he picked up the phone.
Hello.
Hi, is this Jeff Hoops?
Yes, it is.
Hi, my name is Sydney Bowles. I'm a reporter with the Ohio Valley Resource. I'm standing on a railroad with some miners who are protesting the movement of a coal train in Cumberland, Kentucky. And I'm wondering if I could get some comments from you on the situation, why the coal is being moved, and just your response to these miners who are frustrated with the lack of pay.
Yeah, I'm as frustrated as they are. I no longer work for Black Jewel. I resigned more than a month ago, so I really, really have no idea what's going on there. I'm really, really sorry that it's reached this point. So.
These guys are
all I've got to say. No comment.
No comment there from former Black Jewel CEO Jeff Hoops when he picked up the phone when reporter Sydney Bowles called him up. Now, Sydney, let me ask you, did he get any kind of severance package when he stepped down as the Black Jewel CEO?
My understanding is that shortly before the bankruptcy, he did get back some money that he had loaned to Black Jewel. So he's doing just fine. He's also, I think if when we talk to the miners later on in the hour, they may have some thoughts on this as well. But he's also still working on a resort in West Virginia. That my understanding is he's going to be just fine. It's the employees in his company that are still really struggling.
Okay, so let me just ask you quickly, Sydney, and then we'll turn to one of the miners that we have on the line here. Just tell us the train that was full of coal that triggered the protest from the miners or around which they began their protest. Was that was a train that was slated to be delivered to somewhere to be sold, and the miners were saying, well, hang on, if you can sell this train full of coal, you ought to be able to pay us.
Exactly. The ownership of this coal and the status of this coal is hotly debated in federal bankruptcy court in West Virginia right now. To the best of my knowledge, at the current moment, that the coal in that train has been purchased for $1.4 million by a company called Black Jewel Marketing and Sales Holding, which was formed as a part of this bankruptcy to handle some of this, but it's not a debtor to Black Jewel.
Hmm.
So that said, the money has not actually changed hands, and the concern is that as the coal is sitting there exposed to the elements, it's oxidizing, it's losing value, and in fact, if it continues to sit out here in what's still a pretty hot end of the summer here in eastern Kentucky, it may just catch fire.
Wow.
So as these miners are blocking these tracks, as the Department of Labor is intervening to try and argue that the coal can't be moved under the Fair Labor Standards Act, you know, the status of this coal, the value of it is continuing to degrade. So time is of the essence here.
And Sydney, just again, I really appreciate your expertise here because I just want a little bit more context here so the rest of us across the nation can understand what impact this is having in Harlan County. Because Black Jewel employs a couple of thousand people in different states. How large of an employer is it in Harlan County, and what impact is, you know, are the miners not getting paid having on families there?
Right. I mean, I think the impact that this is having across the community can't be overstated, right? I mean, there are at least a couple hundred miners in Harlan County and a couple hundred miners in other counties around the region. When So mining is one of the most lucrative occupations in this part of the country. There aren't a ton of other industries here. Most other people work in healthcare or in fast food or education. There aren't a ton of opportunities for high-paying jobs in this part of the country. So when a large part of the working population loses work, goes without pay, it really impacts not only those families, but also small businesses that those people were frequenting. It impacts restaurants in the area. And I think as time goes on, miners who, you know, had enough in the bank to pay those first month's expenses are finding they don't have enough money for the second month's expenses. Mm-hmm. So they may end up taking a job that has a lower wage, or they may end up leaving this part of the country. And we've already been seeing a declining population in many eastern Kentucky counties, and it's situations like this that continue that trend and make it harder for these counties to sustain themselves going forward.
Yeah. So Sydney Bowles, joining us from Whitesburg, Kentucky, reporter for the Journalism Partnership, Ohio Valley Resource. Hang on here, Sydney, because let's now turn to Jeffrey Willig. He's joining us from Harlan, Kentucky. He's been working at the Clover Lick Mine in Cumberland, Kentucky for 11 years. He's 40 years old, has a wife and six children, was once a plumber in Baltimore, and he moved to Cumberland to work in the mines. So, Jeffrey Willig, welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you very much.
How are you and your family doing right now after all these weeks protesting here?
It's pretty exhausting. I go back and forth from track to home, take the kids to school, trying to help out the wifey as much as I can.
Mm-hmm. Is money getting tight?
Money can be tight for us. We went, you know, from two incomes to one income, and then we have had support though from our community, donating gift cards and stuff like that. Richard Gillum, who once owned the mines, he had come down and made a very big donation, and all the miners had got put on a list, and he had wrote him out a check,
yeah,
each of the miners. So that was a very, very big helpful.
So temporary help there from the former owner of the mine. Jeffrey Willig, joining us from Harlan, Kentucky, and Sydney Bowles with us from Whitesburg, Kentucky. Stand by for just a minute if you could, please. And we're talking about the miners protesting in Harlan County, Kentucky. We want to hear your questions for them about what they think about their futures and the futures for their families. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking today about the miners in Kentucky and their weeks-long protest now against the company that used to own the mine they were working in, and that shut it down and hasn't paid them for months now. I'm joined today by Sydney Bowles. She's a reporter for the Journalism Partnership Ohio Valley Resource. And Jeffrey Willig is also with us. He's been working at the Clover Lick Mine in Cumberland, Kentucky for the past 11 years. And let's listen to the wife of one of the Kentucky miners. Sydney Bowles spoke with this woman. She's named Donna. She'd come down to the train tracks outside the mine where the miners are protesting. She was bringing them water. And here's what she told reporter Sydney Bowles.
It's been hard, and our bills is getting behind, and our vehicle payments are getting behind, and we don't know what we're going to do. Unless they call them back to work, and I don't see it happening.
Also, let's hear from Shane. He's a 29-year-old miner who spoke to Sydney as well, and here's what he said.
Whenever it comes to taking food out of my children's mouth, that's what pisses me off. That's what makes me mad at anything in this world. You can take anything you want to take from me, and you take something from my kids, it's the end for you.
So, Jeffrey Willey, if I can just turn back to you here for a second, how much longer do you think the protest can go on? Because it still seems to be a little uncertain about when the miners might get paid.
We said we're not going to leave until we get paid. And, you know, they did put a 10 to 14 day hold on a decision of if the coal was going to move or not. But we're willing to stick it out as long as we possibly can.
Yeah. You know, we reached out to Black Jewel to see if anyone could join us. They declined, but David Beckman, the chief restructuring officer and interim CEO of the company, sent us a statement. And part of the statement reads that Black Jewel has completed several sale transactions that have been approved by the bankruptcy court, and management is continuing its efforts to complete additional transactions as quickly as possible. We know that each day that passes creates additional hardship for miners who have not yet been brought back to work and their families, and we're doing everything possible to accelerate this process. Mr. Willig, does that statement give you any confidence in the company?
I myself haven't seen that, but no, we haven't heard anything. No one's contacted us since they shut our mine down. I mean, no one's even come down to the tracks and be like, hey, look, you know, we're sorry this happened. I mean, they have not contacted us at all. You know, I read an article where his lawyer was saying, oh, the longer, one of the lawyers of Jeff Hoops was like, the longer they stay on the track, they're just holding up, you know, Copper Gold completing their sale, and that's totally false. So I have no confidence in these people whatsoever. I mean, I go in on my eighth day in a row, and then, you know, they say, oh, Black Jewel claimed bankruptcy, but don't worry, we all have our jobs. Everything's fine and dandy, and we go in, you know, and you know we go 9 miles under a mountain, and 3 hours later we can call back outside, and oh, just call back tomorrow, and then you call back tomorrow, call back next week, then you call back that next week, call back next week. So we never, I mean, it's not your typical layoff. It isn't like, you know, they were like, oh, we're going to lay you off, and you know, here's your severance or whatever, you know. Sorry, you know, we had to claim bankruptcy. You know, I have no confidence in this company and what this man says at all. No, I don't.
Yeah. I mean, if I can jump in as well, I'm looking at a quote from a recent filing in the bankruptcy case, and this is Black Jewel essentially saying, you know, we understand that the way that this has gone down has been a hardship to our employers. But they go on to say, and I'm quoting, the fact remains, however, that the debtors, that's Black Jewel, simply do not have the ability or financial wherewithal to satisfy their employees' claims for pre-petition wages at this time. So they're saying they don't have the money to pay their employees. And they go on to say that prioritizing employees' claims would upset the priority schedule set forth by the court, essentially saying that other creditors are more important than their employees.
Right. That's not unusual in bankruptcy proceedings, right, Sydney?
The deal with bankruptcy is that there are always going to be more people owed money than are able to get everything that they're looking for. That's just the nature of the beast. That said, I think, you know, miners will tell you, Jeffrey may even be able to tell you, that this is far from typical.
Mm-hmm.
This is in violation of Kentucky law, and the Department of Labor is saying that they're in violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act. So, you know, yeah, it's not supposed to go down this way, even in the worst of situations.
Right. So let me just take a quick call here. Let's go to Tyler, who's calling from Sioux City, Iowa. Tyler, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is, what all is the federal government doing to get involved, like the Department of Labor on the side with Black Jewel not paying these workers for so long, which is, it's a clear violation of wages and hours. laws that are under the Department of Labor. And then on the other side, what is any kind of enforcement or anything on like the miners blocking the train? Is there anything that's being said to them that you can't block the tracks and you know you're reaching past your right of protest?
Okay, so Tyler, thank you for your call. Let's take the second part of his question first. Jeffrey Willig, has anyone told you that you can't be on the tracks anymore?
No, we're backed up by our local mayor, our local police force, our judge executive, Dan Mosley. He has not, you know, said, hey, Paul Browning, our representative. No, everyone's backing us up. They've supplied us with a light. Sorry, man. A light and everything for at night. They supplied us with, you know, places to use the bathroom and everything.
Mm-hmm. And Sydney,
so no, they're not.
Okay, so you got a lot of support from the community. That's absolutely
correct.
Clear. Yeah. So Sydney, about the first question the caller asked, you mentioned that the NLRB has already said that the company is in violation of certain labor standards. Any further involvement though coming from the federal government?
Right, yeah. We haven't had, to the best of my knowledge, we haven't had statements from the president or other parts of the federal government, but the Department of Labor has been a part of this bankruptcy case. They have filed a motion with the federal bankruptcy court in West Virginia, and I believe in Virginia as well, to classify the coal that's being blockaded, the coal that was mined in the last month of Black Jewel's operation, as hot goods, which means that it was produced in violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act, and that it can't be moved across state lines until that's rectified, until miners get their pay. So Black Jewel has filed back with a motion of their own, disputing that, arguing that they can't afford to pay. The current status of that, there was a hearing a few days ago where the judge basically punted on it, pushed the hearing to what I believe should be, Jeffrey, probably like a week from now, do you think? I don't think they've set an official date.
No, they said 10 to 14 days as far as the movement of the coal, correct?
I see.
Yeah. So that should be coming up soon, and hopefully that should get some much-deserved answers for Jeffrey and the other guys at the blockade.
Yeah. And by the way, Sydney and Jeffrey, just so you know, we've been trying to get miner Chris Rowe on the phone here, having a little bit of trouble doing that, but we'll keep working on it, see if we can get him in this conversation. But Jeffrey, if I can, I want to play a clip from you, a clip for you, by the way, because, you know, in talking about potential federal government involvement, of course, the president has, you know, for a long time been a really big booster and supporter of coal miners and the coal industry. But as far as we can tell thus far, he hasn't said anything in particular about your protest and what's happened with Black Jewel. On CNN, though, Brandon Pearson, a Black Jewel plant mechanic, he actually appealed directly to the president.
We need Donald J. Trump to come to coal country. You know, we voted for that man. You know, he said he would be here for coal miners. I've seen him with the UMWA hat on. I've seen him with the hard hat on, you know, said, I'm here for you. You know, we're going to make America great again. We're going to put people back to work again. You know, and I'm not blaming this on him. This is not his fault in any shape, form, or fashion, you know, because I know he's there for us, and we need him here.
Jeffrey Willig, would you like to have the president's involvement in this?
I have no comment as far as politics. We did not make this political at whatsoever when you know, me and four other guys stopped that train. And when we were on the news, we were like, we're not making this political. So I'm not pointing fingers at no politician.
Okay. No, I can respect that a lot. But if I may, though, I just want to ask you, though, I am, you want to get paid. That fundamentally is what the miners want. Totally understand that. But all, at the same time, in the White House, there is a man, the president, who has vocally supported miners for a couple of years now. Would it be helpful if he, you know, said anything in support of what you're trying to do there?
Again, no comment. Okay. I don't. It's just between me, you know, the other miners, and a guy that thought he was going to get away with it. If that train went down that line, if we didn't first stop that train, he would have got away with it.
Yeah.
You know, this guy is a criminal. And you know, I mean, my wife and I, we get on our app and we're, you know, $3,000 negative in our bank account mm-hmm. because our checks bounced. So, you know, I mean, you know, no politician is involved in this whatsoever. It's this guy. Mm-hmm. This guy, Jeff Hoops, has destroyed people's lives while he gets to go to bed at night, sleep comfortably, go to his $32 million golf resort that he's building, get, you know, he made an a statement like, I had to get in my own personal jet, you know, for my personal vacation. Wow, that really hurts me, guy. You had to get in your personal jet. Like, that's spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that really hurt my feelings. Well, my six kids, that's two of them with autism, can't have something due to the fact of what you did. I don't find real pity on your personal jet there, pal. How about you sell your personal jet and pay what you pay the people what they have worked for? You know, when we first started it, we just wanted our money, our checks. We weren't nothing, asking for nothing extra. We were just like, hey, we'll leave the tracks once you pay us our money.
I mean,
you know, them checks were going to bounce.
Yeah. Go ahead, Sydney.
Sorry, Jeffrey, you and I have talked a bunch of times. I feel like I probably might see you later, too. I feel like you can tell me if you feel differently than other people that I've talked to about this, but I feel like in the month that I've been hanging out there at the blockade with you guys, excuse me, I feel like miners have, the Black Jewel miners have moved in some way, at least some of you guys, from simply like, I was done wrong, I want to get paid, to more of a sense of like solidarity with other working class people, you know, seeing ways in which other working class people have also been done wrong, and even connecting your own lack of payment or your own protest to protests that happened in Harlan County previously mm-hmm. and thinking of yourselves as part of that legacy. Does that feel like, was that part of your experience, Jeffrey?
Yeah, I definitely felt that way. Apparently, we've had a couple people coming up to us that are part of the working class and was like, hey, you know, do you realize that you're strengthening people? And recently there's been a AT&T here in Harlan County. I haven't been to it myself, but they went on strike apparently due to the fact that, and it's not just in Kentucky, it's other places that people are, the trucking industry is doing similar actions now.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey, can I ask, are you a member of the United Mine Workers?
No, I'm a non-union worker.
Okay. Is there maybe a growing appetite for union membership or growing the union now?
I myself, from a personal experience, I think there should have been union involved. You know, because this wouldn't have happened. I think that union should come back as far as coal mining. If you're going to have that coal mining, you know, stay strong in your areas, I mean, I think the union should come back. But there is a lot of people that have sour taste. I've worked with gentlemen that's been on the ground for 30, 40 years, you know, great people. And, you know, there's some, though, that they just have a sour taste mm-hmm. for unions here.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey, can we just take a step back here for a second? Because I'd love to hear from you about the work itself. How, do you love being a miner?
I love coal mining. It's you know, I never have to worry about the weather. As far as, you know, working conditions, the same temperature around all year long. Yes, there's loud equipment and stuff, but it's actually peaceful work. I mean, and you get to go. I mean, it sounds funny, but you do get to go where no person's gone before, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
And the atmosphere of the other workers, you know, I've worked with multicultural people of, you know, all race, color, and religion and everything. And, you know, and it's, coal miners are just, I guess they're like roofers. They're just a different breed mm-hmm. of people. And everyone looks out for each other. You know, I've been at jobs where, you know, people were just like, just totally rude to each other, you know, just real selfish and everything. And when you work underground next to a person, you see them basically more your family, your own family. So you guys become family and, you know, just very unselfish people, you know, like for example, you know, I may go, oh, man, you know, I forgot my Red Bull or my soda, you know, like, here, man, here, I have the extra one,
right.
You know, and
I imagine
just,
when
stuff
you're,
like that.
When you're in the mine, you really have to rely on each other and get along. We got a minute, though, Jeffrey. Is this a job that you want your kids to do when they grow up?
I want my kids to go to college. I don't want them to make money with their back. I want them to make money with their mind.
Mm-hmm.
But that's with any job, not just with coal mining. I mean, any backlander job, nobody wants their children to, you know, they want their children to succeed and be more successful than them. If you care and really love your kids, that's how I feel. And that's how I feel. You know, of course, you know, I want my children to be able, you know, to be more. And I think a lot of miners will tell you that. You know, they want to be their kids to be more successful than they were. Could they get in coal mining, energy, far as engineering? Absolutely. I would totally support, yes.
Well, Jeffrey Willig, he's been working at the Cloverlick Mine in Cumberland, Kentucky for the past 11 years. He's one of the Kentucky miners protesting the company that used to own the mine he worked in, the Black Jewel. Jeffrey Willig, thank you so much.
Oh, no problem.
It's great to have
you. Thank you for your support.
Yeah. And Sydney Bowles, reporter for the journalism partnership Ohio Valley Resource. She works out of the public radio station WWMT. We have a link to her reporting about the miners' strike, or miners' protest, I should say, at onpointradio.org. Sydney Bowles, it was great to have you. Thank you so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
But when we come back, we'll talk about Boris Johnson, Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and his suspension of the British Parliament. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunio was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's getting pretty hectic in London ever since British Prime Minister Boris Johnson decided to suspend Parliament for 5 weeks. Politicians resigning, protests outside the House of Commons, all in response to Johnson's extraordinary move, again, to suspend Parliament in September so that he can force through Brexit. It's a pretty unprecedented move in terms of the length of the suspension. So we want to know what you think. Do you think Boris Johnson, Britain's Prime Minister, was bold and brave to suspend Parliament to push through a no-deal Brexit? Or, like the House of Commons Speaker John Bercow said, it's an offense against the democratic process. What do you think? Joining us now from Birmingham, England, is Malcolm Brabant. For years, he was an award-winning correspondent with the BBC. He's frequently on PBS NewsHour, where he's a special correspondent as well. Malcolm, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. So first of all, I said that the Prime Minister's suspension of Parliament was unprecedented due to the length of the suspension. Is that right? Is this a really bold move by Johnson?
In terms of the length, it is unprecedented, but Parliament is frequently suspended by, you know, Prime Ministers when they want to introduce a new legislative period. And what he would argue is that all he's done is just to extend this by a couple of extra weeks in order to be able to get his new legislative program through. When Parliament comes back from its annual vacation, which is normally next week sometime, then the MPs, members of Parliament, then disappear to various conferences around the country. And that's normal. What he's done is he's extended that 3-week conference period by an extra couple of weeks. But his main objective, basically, is to stop the stalemate that has thwarted Brexit over the past 3 years. And he's being slightly disingenuous when he says that his main objective is to get this legislative period through. I mean, that is the truth. But, you know, what he's really trying to do is to thwart those people who want to make sure that he can't make Britain crash out of the European Union on October the 31st without a deal. But what he's also trying to do is to sharpen the minds also of the Europeans with whom he's going to have to negotiate, to make it absolutely clear to them that he's serious about crashing out he's serious about leaving on the 31st, and that he wants to make sure that there is going to be no more of these delays.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he's hoping to do is to sort of, I think, sharpen the minds of the negotiators on the European side so that they are prepared to make some concessions, which will ultimately enable him to leave with a deal, which is what he says he wants to do, because the consequences of leaving without a deal are uncertain, and there could be sort of major disruption.
Okay, so Malcolm, you've said a bunch of things there that I want to explore with you in a little bit more detail. So first of all, back up here for just a second, if you could, Johnson is saying that he wants to be able to break the stalemate, essentially. But aren't his critics saying, well, by doing that, you're essentially saying that you don't want Parliament to further debate Brexit, that what you're doing is breaking British democracy by suspending Parliament?
Well, I mean, those people who say that he's breaking democracy are those people who possibly have been thwarting democracy, because those people who are in favour of Brexit would say that the British people decided on 2016 that they wanted to leave, and they had a promise that Parliament would facilitate the departure from the European Union, but nothing has happened. And over the past couple of years, and especially in the past sort of 6 months, as leaving the European Union has become more urgent, as far as Brexit is concerned, Parliament has just debated and debated, and it's just not been able to make up its mind. And some people are saying that just stop this conversation now, because it's going nowhere. Parliament simply is so heavily divided, it cannot make up its mind.
But if I may be clear, though, and correct me, Malcolm, correct me if I'm wrong. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But part of the reason why Theresa May couldn't get her Brexit deal through Parliament three times in a row wasn't just because of the Remainers, but it was because of the Boris Johnson wing of the Tory party. They, too, didn't want that deal. So whoever's stopping it wasn't just Remainers.
No, but it is pretty complex.
Yeah.
The reason behind it. I mean, but many people would say that one of the reasons why Theresa May failed was that she basically took a hard Brexit off the table, and this comes down to how you negotiate. I mean, this is a huge debate in Britain about the way in which you try to sort of forge a deal. And people who come from a business background say you have to have the ability to be able to walk away with nothing if you're prepared to get the deal you want. But what Parliament did was basically to say, well, we're not going to allow you to break out without a deal. And so that stymied, in a way, the possibility of getting a decent deal. And that's what Boris Johnson is trying to get around.
Has Donald Tusk or any member, any decision maker in the European Union shown any willingness to go back to the negotiating table in the face of a hard Brexit? I mean, they've been pretty staunch in their position, haven't they?
Well, Donald Tusk has, but actually there has been movement with Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, and also with President Macron of France. It has to be said that Chancellor Merkel's position is slightly weaker than it used to be, because she's basically on the way down the pecking order in Europe, and so Macron is potentially sort of the more important member of the partnership here. But Boris Johnson had meetings with both Macron and with Merkel, and he extracted a promise from Angela Merkel that he could have 30 days to come up with an alternative, and she's willing to do that. So her influence within the European Union, despite the fact that she's on the wane politically and influentially, is still really quite substantial. And so we're waiting to see in the next month or so what Boris Johnson is going to come up with in terms of his negotiating position, to see whether or not that will satisfy the likes of Angela Merkel and others, so that perhaps there can be a renegotiation. And that basically comes down to the situation in Ireland. And what everybody wants to be able to do is to maintain an open border, while at the same time not sort of tying Britain completely to the terms of the European Union indefinitely. And that's been the big objections from the Brexiteers, is that they feel as though they're going to be tied to the terms and conditions of the European Union because they have to keep that border open. So, what they're trying to do is to come up with, what Boris Johnson needs to do is to become able to come up with a new solution which keeps a soft border so that there can be a free flow of goods and people across, without having border posts in, which was one of the reasons, these were flashpoints during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and having a soft border has been one of the things that's maintained the peace there.
One must imagine that the people in Ireland feel like, are they being treated like a sacrificial lamb at the altar of Brexit here? That is a very hard-won peace you're talking about in Ireland.
Well, yeah, it is. But it is extremely complex. But I mean, some people would say that one of the problems is that you've got a very determined and intransigent prime minister or a Taoiseach in the Irish Republic. Who is perhaps coming under pressure from? I mean, he has basically said that the deal as it stands at the moment has to stand, but he may come under pressure from business people in Ireland to sort of soften his stance. Excuse me. And also, I mean, if the proposal that the administration of Boris Johnson comes up with meets with the approval of Angela Merkel, then you may find that the Irish Taoiseach comes under pressure to modify his stance, because if it's acceptable to the EU, then maybe it'll be acceptable to the Irish as well. So they're in a very difficult position, and it is complicated by all of the troubles that there have been in the past. And nobody, I mean, including Boris Johnson, wants to go back to those troubles at all. I mean, people like peace; they don't like conflict. And there have been signs that there are still some hardline Republicans who are trying to sort of capitalise on the kind of climate, and are interested in stoking up violence. Mm. So it's a very, very sensitive subject.
It is, and I have to say, from my perspective here in the United States, though, it stretches the imagination to think that in the next 5 or 6 weeks they can come up with a solution to this Irish problem that they couldn't come up with for 3 years.
Oh, well, I'm not a negotiator. I haven't been sort of party to the negotiations. And yes, I mean, it does seem like, they've had 3 years to get it sorted out, and, they haven't done it. So how are they going to do it in a short space of time? But the thing is, sometimes having a deadline, having an imperative to sort things out sharpens people's minds, and, maybe they're able to come up with a solution.
Nothing like a deadline to get things done. Let's just go to a caller really quick. Let's go to Jill, who's calling from Winterset, Iowa. Jill, you're on the air.
Hi. My comment is, I believe that this is an undermining of world democracy globally via the efforts of Putin, via social media, the bots, the trolls, and people complicit inside England and Europe. And including Boris Johnson. Mm. I think it's going to be catastrophic for democracy around the world.
Jill, thank you for your call. Malcolm, would you like to respond to Jill?
I don't know how to respond to that, to be perfectly honest. I mean, having sort of seen Boris Johnson, over the past 20 years or so, I don't think for one second that, there's any kind of interference or manipulation taking part on the part of Russians at all. He's a very independently minded person, and I don't think that there's any sort of conspiracy attached to him whatsoever.
Okay. Let's go to Nancy, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Nancy, you're on the air.
Okay. Yes, I think the British people should demand another referendum, because it's been 3 years since the original referendum was taken, and I think the vote would probably come out in favor of remaining in the EU. Because the people of the United Kingdom are more knowledgeable now about the devastating effects that would result mm-hmm. if they left the Union. That backstop in Ireland, I'm telling you right now, that problem cannot be solved. Yeah. It cannot be solved, because this is part of the peace agreement after that horrible fighting that went on, and killing and mm-hmm. death that went on in Ireland. Yeah. The open border was part of that agreement. Now, if they take that Good Friday agreement away, there will be chaos probably in Ireland, and people are aware that this is going to cause horrible chaos and horrible problems in Ireland. Right. And also,
Nancy, I'm going to take it back from you because I appreciate your call. And the first part of your call, I want to get Malcolm's thoughts on, because there have been calls from various sectors of UK government for another referendum, another vote. Lots of people object to that, saying that it would be anti-democratic because there was already a vote in 2016. So I guess the question is, like, what sort of form of affront against democracy do you want? Do you want another referendum, or do you want Parliament suspended? I don't even know how to think about this anymore, Malcolm.
Well, I mean, there are many people who think that referenda are a very sort of bad way of going about sort of determining a country's future. And, I mean, if you want to look at the root causes of the problems that Britain have got right now, it is that the then Prime Minister who agreed to the referendum, David Cameron, did so against the advice of many other people. He said that he should have put other safeguards in place to make sure that when the country made its decision, that it would be a decision that could be accepted by the rest of the country. Now, if you were to do this in America, what I suspect you would have to have is the same sort of majorities you have in the House of Representatives and in the Senate. You'd have to have a two-thirds majority. Unfortunately, what happened was that Cameron agreed to a referendum which was determined to be 50% plus mm-hmm. one. Mm-hmm. And just to reiterate the result of the referendum, it was 52% in favor of Brexit and 48% against. But those people who argue against a second referendum, say that, what do you want to do? Do you want to keep having, referenda until you get the result you want? And the problem was, there was a cast iron promise given that the outcome of that referendum in 2016 would be respected. And that is the, regardless of the political sort of rhetoric that went on at the time. And I mean, this is completely uncharted territory.
Right.
But, if the finger of history, I suspect, will point very, very badly at David Cameron for having sort of created this, this terrible division, because Britain really is split. It's split, amongst families, friends are breaking up. And there was a columnist in the Guardian newspaper yesterday who talked about there being, a civil war mentality. Now, I mean, I've, been to sort of the odd civil war, and I think she's being extreme. But, I think that, the divisions that have been caused as a result of this are going to take a generation to heal, because people are really, the census is really visceral. And it's I've only just come back to Britain after 30 years away. And I find it extremely painful to see, my friends being sort of split, down the middle. Well, I have to say, I don't have that many friends on the Brexit side of the other line, which probably sort of tells you about the kind of liberal friendships I have on Facebook or whatever. But you don't see many people going on about Brexit on my Facebook pages. So that's not to say, I'm not telling you, where I stand on this side of the line. I mean, it's as a person who's reporting Britain as a foreign country, I find it fascinating the kind of convulsions the country is going through.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier that those in favor of Brexit keep asking, well, how many referendums can you have until you get the result that you want? I imagine that those opposed to Brexit right now are saying, well, how often can you suspend Parliament until you get the result you want? I mean, that is the visceral nature of the split here that you're talking about. I mean, Malcolm, we've got about a minute left here to go. Can you tell us about some of the, how's the Labour Party reacting to Johnson's suspension of Parliament?
Well, the Labour Party is basically saying that, it's a smash and grab on democracy. Other people are calling it a constitutional coup. And people are sort of upset that the Queen has been dragged into this. But, I mean, the problem is that Britain actually doesn't have a written constitution. Everything we have here is kind of its protocol and its convention and habit and precedent. And that's why, it's so vague. If we had a written constitution, then, perhaps the courts could stop what has happened. And there's been some interesting legal advice, which one of which is that if it's been proved that the Boris Johnson has misled the Queen, then perhaps he might possibly face sort of challenges in the High Court over that. But the way it stands, the suspension of Parliament's going ahead.
Yeah. Well, Malcolm Broadbent joining us from Birmingham, England, special correspondent for the PBS NewsHour, former BBC national and international correspondent as well. Malcolm, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
C Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.